Chapter 23, Togetherness, the I Ching, and the Honeymoon in Nepal. A day or so passed, and the time came to pick up Luis from the airport. They spotted him easily as he got off the plane, and there were hugs and kisses all around. From there, they walked to an airport restaurant to pause and collect their thoughts. Steve showed a book of I Ching to Luis and asked if he had heard of it. "Yes, of course," Luis said. "Do you want to throw one and see what's in store for us?" Steve said he didn't know whether he believed in divination, but that he thought putting an objective goal in front of them and trying to catch the spirit of the movement is very useful. He mumbled that he often thought that sometimes divination can work, but he didn't put his faith in it. "I thought we might pray that we get an oracle about family. Whether it works or not, I would like all of you to pray that we will get the message pertaining to us as a family." Everyone nodded in approval, and there was a moment of silence while each prayed in his or her own way. Steve threw the I Ching. It came up, treading conduct. "Apparently we have to look where we are walking. In the commentary it says, the one-eyed man sees, but not clearly. What do you think this means?" Luis said, "I suppose that you have tried drugs. Many times I can imagine you didn't know where exactly you were walking or treading as if blind in one eye. I did also when I was younger. I often felt like I was a man who only partly saw the truth. Even though I imagined I could see things clearly, I only saw things through my own absolutist one-eyed perception of the world. I knew I was inwardly righteous, but I was not really too different from those people who spoke about power for power's sake. And God was a word that these conservatives could easily roll off their tongue. But somehow they lived in an even more one-eyed darkness. While I thought that it was very complicated and full of hidden meaning to know the Godhead, they thought it was simple. I suppose if you are strong-willed or are in full control of your senses, you think you have the acquisitive power of God naturally within you and don't need to suffer to find the obvious. Acquisition can be imperial and negative, too. Maybe they just were power-hungry and used the word God to convert people. This specific divination, I think, means that when we are fully announced publicly, it would be nice to not come across as freed revolutionaries, but freed individuals who are universally Christian and practical, walking in good conduct on both sides of the road with a mystic slant, accepting everybody who has love in their hearts. We should conduct ourselves humbly. We must reach those who wouldn't normally trust us. We should have two eyes. Maybe we should have the mea culpa attitude that we have acquired during our searches and learn from our mistakes and accept partial responsibility for our fitful fates. Maybe not the kidnapping part, but our stigmatization as revolutionaries. I think we can say that it was necessary to learn some lessons in the manner that we did, but there is always a better way that involves having better conduct. That could relate to the conduct part of the oracle. Maybe we should say we have the tiger by the tail now, like it says here in the divination," Maria muttered, as she looked through the book. "We have learned our lessons about drugs. We have conquered our curiosity for them. We have learned what we could from that path, which is now too dangerous for us, and we have found that we can continue in a different way." Bev said, "Like yin and yang, guilt and blamelessness sometimes can chase each other like two fishes. I see it talks about blamelessness, too, in the hexagram. It's all relative, but we can't escape from being relative to what we do and being relative to everything in the world." The families were having an immense amount of fun in the dawn of their new life. Their other members of their companies were understanding and allowed them freedom to be creative. But now there were more of them, and the parents took on roles as advisors to Steve and Maria in their business ventures. They worked together to build the new telescope business. They planned to make telescopes with a diameter as big as 16 inches, which is about the diameter of the largest amateur telescope. They also worked quickly to organize their Hindu wedding at the Guru's San Francisco temple. All of their friends were invited, and it wasn't long before the big day arrived. Everyone wore tikas, which is the mask on the forehead that depicts the inner eye. Little Bird gave a speech about one of the Hindu wedding vows, to uphold the Dharma. He assured the guests that the Dharma, brilliantly exuding from the couple's third eyes, would light the twilight path of all individuals who would follow them. Steve interrupted to praise his friend. He said he considered Little Bird responsible for nurturing and preserving the Dharma, or God vision, within himself through his rituals surrounding the belief that humans originated from a twilight world to be born again into a bright, sunlit world. Steve said he equated Dharma with vision, even though it sometimes embodied many definitions and methods of conduct. He felt that if you couldn't see where you were going, you couldn't conduct yourself correctly. Then he thanked Little Bird again for his mentoring. After the day-long ritual, Steve and Maria left for their honeymoon in Nepal. Since they bonded so well with their new families, feeling unable to separate themselves from their long-lost parents, Frank and Bev and Louise accompanied the newlyweds. The honeymoon was spent in a medium-sized rented house in Nepal near a hospital. When Maria went into labor, she would have the baby there. Before the trip, Maria had an ultrasound that revealed no abnormalities, so they had no fear that they might need a special hospital for delivery. A week or so after they arrived, Maria finally went into labor and gave birth to a healthy boy. Nepal proved to be a beautiful experience for all of them. The families enjoyed the mountains and decided to stay until they all could go hiking together. Maria rested and waited for the time when she would be strong enough to accompany them into the mountains. The time finally came when she felt she was fit, and they all took a short hike into the footpath near their house. After only a few hours, they returned. Maria was still a little weak, but stood up well to the exertion. The guru had been carefully watching the child, and when they returned to the house, she hurried to reclaim care of the bundle held tenderly in her arms. She bent over the tiny child and cooed, smiling and shaking his rattle. As they left the path, she had bought a little statue of the future Buddha, Maitreya, for the baby to play with. It was made of cheap molded plastic, but Maria thought it would be safe for him to play with. As she gave it to him, she said, "You will be the future Buddha, my sweet one." The statue made the baby happy. The child giggled and laughed, holding the statue in a tight grip. She played with the baby for a while and then put him back in the crib. Tired from the walk, she turned on some music and fell asleep in the rocking chair beside his cradle, where she dreamt a strange dream. She was a little girl again in Colombia. Her real father, announcing he would take a nap, walked up a flight of stairs. In Spanish, he told the maid to watch closely over Maria. Maria herself was about a year and a half old. The maid, wretchedly unfaithful to their family, left Maria unattended, causing Maria to fret. On the wall was a painting of an eagle soaring through the stairs with a baby in its talons. Suddenly, some tough people and the couple who would masquerade as her parents ran in and kidnapped her. One of them said to the driver, "Vemos tenemos calle, vaya derecho, pare, seis, cuadras, pues de calle las águilas, después vaya allá derecha y sobre la carretera. Go, quickly, we have to leave. Go straight 3 blocks on the Street of the Eagles, then turn right and get on the highway." After an intermediate length of time, they stopped in front of a house. They took her inside and slapped her around. A tall, burly man held her above his head, then let go, letting her fall to the hard wood floor at his feet. She lost consciousness. Maria awoke screaming. Everyone rushed into the room. Frightened, she recounted the dream, not knowing if she was retelling a nightmare or a long-forgotten memory. Louise said, "I know that was a dream of remembering because we lived on Las Aguilas Street, which means eagle, and I had a painting of an eagle with a baby in the stars on the wall. It was a surrealistic painting of an old constellation. I had painted it with you in mind, my baby. I brought with me my photo album and a scrapbook with that very painting in it. I wanted to show it to you, but was waiting for the right time." He rose to retrieve it. Maria nearly screamed when she saw the painting and the pictures of the house. "Papa! The painting looked exactly the same as the dream, and the house is exactly as it was in the dream. I remembered! I am whole again!" Steve said, "I wish I could remember before I was 2. Maybe I had been abused too and have repressed the memory." He shook his head lightly, wanting to address another matter. "I want to relate some pressing news. A leader of our communal operations called and said that the president has invited us to appear in Senate hearings about abuses in Colombia. They are inviting a team of surviving members of the families that had been separated or killed during the coup. He wants to ask them if they know anything and if they would give a statement of thanks to the U.S. government. Shall we go?" Maria and Louise nodded their heads. "Yes, of course!" "Good, I'll let him know. The hearings will be in 2 weeks," Steve added. They went on a few more hikes into the mountains, and when they had satisfied their lust for the mysteries of Nepal, they went back to San Francisco. As they waited impatiently to appear in the Senate, news was leaked that Steve and Maria had uncovered the truth of their kidnappings. Their CD sales soared. Soon they couldn't go anywhere without being noticed, and they arrived in Washington amidst much press coverage. When Maria got to the hearing, she sat next to the family waiting nervously to be interviewed. The head of the review board opened up by stating, "We know you and your family have suffered many blows and now are standing tall and proud. What do you have to say about your ordeal?" "I want to give thanks to the U.S. government and the security departments for their help in proving that we have been kidnapped," Maria began. "Steve and I argued and reasoned that we, as well as society, didn't know what real uncorrupt flesh and blood was, since we lived in limbo and doubt about what real truth was about our relation to the world. I mean this in the sense that we had our ignorance unable to separate the truth from lies, because truth had been hidden from us. We argued that our use of spiritual, personal, and scientific judgment could be decisive in separating the flesh and blood of the fakers, who were then only supposed kidnappers, from the flesh and blood of true spirit, which we knew ought to be our real parents and ourselves, but had no proof. The president, in his altruism, helped us separate the untruth from truth." At this point, Steve rose to speak. "In our search for the truth, we came across a saying that had a lot of influence upon us. The spoken word truth, which linked itself to our feelings in relation to our attitudes of meekness of self, is the self-effacing saying of non-ego that caused us to believe that the spirits of the one mind is egoless and nameless. Assertions and presumptions of the self were futile and meaningless. We almost totally accepted this truth in the beginning and didn't try to give a substantive name to this truth. We thought it was presumptuous and limiting to label the ethereal spirit and to give it a material foundation. We were given new names to live by that had deep meaning to us, names that were forged in true family ties, making us all more one, not those of false parentage. We finally decided that our kidnappers had stolen the truth from us in spirit and in word, much like ignorance robs a child of its abilities to search freely for means and wisdom. We decided to ask questions. We knew innately that we were part of the one truth, and those kidnappers were not. We decided to be practical and resolutely tried to form, by deduction, a way in which we could cause the truth to be made flesh. We wanted to have identity and to label that identity. This led to DNA testing. It also led us to suspect that sometimes the truth and spirit of humanity are held hostage, kidnapped even, and always is in denial about being in bondage to something that is not of the truth. May I ask, is it possible that truth can be kidnapped? The president has helped us dispel false truth that appeared as truth in flesh. We were given new worthy names to cling to, which in reality defined the truth for the better, practically and spiritually. He removed the honor from those who had claimed to be our faithful fathers and mothers, who had said they were faithful to God but were not. By applying science to something we knew only in spirit, we learned that their names and their flesh were corrupt and heretical. There was nothing true about them, not scientifically, not spiritually. We think this is the true reason why the spirit remains nameless. Nameless are the orphans of the truth. We thank you for making this truth manifest. My father will testify shortly. He might know the names of others who Maria and I call corrupt in the flesh in the sense that they have passion for deceit. He alone might be able to enlighten you about this deceit and this miscarriage of truth. I am only able to thank you, and the Godhead thanks you." The end. Written by John Rhodes. Read by Michael Butler.